Scottish Qualifications Authority, National Qualifications
2022,
English for Speakers of Other Languages, National 5, Listening. Recording 1. Listen to the recording and attempt the questions which follow. You will hear the recording twice. You now have 1 minute to read the questions in recording 1 before the recording begins.
Welcome to Radio Caledonia. This is me, Susan MacDonald, with you for the next 2 hours talking about the issues of the day. Now, did you all have a good sleep in your warm beds last night? If so, spare a thought for those who are not so lucky. Josh Littlejohn needs no introduction. He and Alice Thompson founded the charity Social Bite in 2012 to tackle homelessness. This is the charity that brought Hollywood celebrities to its Edinburgh Cafe. Josh has also persuaded hundreds of volunteers to sleep outside, the first big sleep out, in Princes Street Gardens in Edinburgh on a cold winter night to raise funds for the homeless. The Social Bite Village is the latest in a long line of accomplishments. Here, Josh talks about their latest venture, the Social Bite Village in Granton, Edinburgh.
The Village project aims to give homeless people a chance to get off the streets and to go and live for a while in a community. There, they'll be helped by Edinburgh charity, Serenians, to get back on their feet, no matter what their problems are. The project's cost about £750,000, but that's probably half the cost it should have been. We've had so much support in the way of architecture and engineering. Most of the materials that make up the houses were donated by over 100 companies in the construction industry. And it wasn't just the materials that were donated, it was labour as well, from joiners, plasterers, plumbers, and all sorts. The Village project was largely funded by a sleepout by company executives last year. That night we raised about £500,000. The money raised from the big sleepout this year, around £4 million, will be devoted to a big Housing First programme, which runs parallel to this one. Housing First is trying to help people who find themselves homeless, primarily rough sleepers and people on the streets, who are the most severe instances of homelessness, helping them into mainstream flats. There's also quite comprehensive and flexible support to go with these flats, so we're just about to start quite a significant programme across 5 cities. We're working with the City Council and the Scottish Government to push that programme forward. We're also working with the Serenians charity to choose the residents of the village. It's largely done as an opt-in. In most homelessness services, there's very little choice because you're told where you'll live. The plan here is to advertise it across hostels, B&Bs and night shelters, but also through our Social Bite shops, where we engage with hundreds of homeless people. We've already had a few referrals from that kind of place. People will then apply to come and live here. The village is based on the idea of community, where people will support each other. When residents come to live in the village, there's intensive support, with 5 full-time staff from Serenians on site. There's also a strong voluntary presence, and there'll be 24/7 support. We envisage that people will live here for 12 to 18 months, supporting each other to get back on their feet. Then, we hope the residents will be supported into mainstream accommodation. It feels very tranquil and safe here, and we hope that the residents feel that too. While living here, there are loads of plants which will need to be looked after. And right next door there's the walled garden, and the community group there will invite the residents in to help out. But there are also lots of links to mainstream employment. Lots of employers have pledged employment opportunities. We also have a relationship established with local colleges, which are offering quite tailored and flexible academic courses. So if people want to get trained or qualified in a particular area, they can do that. We're very outward-looking, and hopefully people will get new experiences, employment, or education, or whatever they want out of it. I believe that we can reach zero homelessness in Scotland. It's simply a matter of focus, and I hope this project will help with that.
Thanks very much for that, Josh. And now let's go over to Lorraine with the weather. Welcome to Radio Caledonia. This is me, Susan McDonald, with you for the next 2 hours talking about the issues of the day. Now, did you all have a good sleep in your warm beds last night? If so, spare a thought for those who are not so lucky. Josh Littlejohn needs no introduction. He and Alice Thompson founded the charity Social Bite in 2012 to tackle homelessness. This is the charity that brought Hollywood celebrities to its Edinburgh cafe. Josh has also persuaded hundreds of volunteers to sleep outside, the first big sleep out, in Princes Street Gardens in Edinburgh on a cold winter night to raise funds for the homeless. The Social Bite Village is the latest in a long line of accomplishments. Here, Josh talks about their latest venture, the Social Bite Village in Granton, Edinburgh.
The village project aims to give homeless people a chance to get off the streets and to go and live for a while in a community. There, they'll be helped by Edinburgh charity, Serenians, to get back on their feet, no matter what their problems are. The project's cost about £750,000, but that's probably half the cost it should have been. We've had so much support in the way of architecture and engineering. Most of the materials that make up the houses were donated by over 100 companies in the construction industry. And it wasn't just the materials that were donated, it was labour as well, from joiners, plasterers, plumbers, and all sorts. The village project was largely funded by a sleepout by company executives last year. That night we raised about £500,000. The money raised from the big sleepout this year, around £4 million, will be devoted to a big Housing First programme, which runs parallel to this one. Housing First is trying to help people who find themselves homeless, primarily rough sleepers and people on the streets, who are the most severe instances of homelessness, helping them into mainstream flats. There's also quite comprehensive and flexible support to go with these flats, so we're just about to start quite a significant programme across 5 cities. We're working with the City Council and the Scottish Government to push that programme forward. We're also working with the Serenians charity to choose the residents of the village. It's largely done as an opt-in. In most homelessness services, there's very little choice because you're told where you'll live. The plan here is to advertise it across hostels, B&Bs and night shelters, but also through our Social Bite shops, where we engage with hundreds of homeless people. We've already had a few referrals from that kind of place. People will then apply to come and live here. The village is based on the idea of community, where people will support each other. When residents come to live in the village, there's intensive support, with 5 full-time staff from Serenians on site. There's also a strong voluntary presence, and there'll be 24/7 support. We envisage that people will live here for 12 to 18 months, supporting each other to get back on their feet. Then, we hope the residents will be supported into mainstream accommodation. It feels very tranquil and safe here, and we hope that the residents feel that too. While living here, there are loads of plants which will need to be looked after. And right next door, there's the walled garden, and the community group there will invite the residents in to help out. But there are also lots of links to mainstream employment. Lots of employers have pledged employment opportunities. We also have a relationship established with local colleges, which are offering quite tailored and flexible academic courses. So if people want to get trained or qualified in a particular area, they can do that. We're very outward-looking, and hopefully people will get new experiences, employment, or education, or whatever they want out of it. I believe that we can reach zero homelessness in Scotland. It's simply a matter of focus, and I hope this project will help with that.
Thanks very much for that, Josh. And now let's go over to Lorraine with the weather.
Recording 2. Listen to the recording and attempt the questions which follow. You will hear the recording twice. You now have 1 minute to read the questions in recording 2 before the recording begins.
Do you ever feel like a hamster caught up in a wheel? Working day in, day out, and craving Fridays. Then, before you know it, it's Monday again. Well, fear no more, because that could all be about to change. With me in the studio is Eddie Green, founder of Webcraft, an innovative website design company in Glasgow, employing 25 people.
Hi there. Good to be here.
Eddie, you've started to make big changes to the working week. Can you tell us what arrangement your company has?
Yeah, sure. As a small company just starting up, a few of the senior staff used to work almost 7 days per week when things got really busy in the first year or two. But since then, things have changed dramatically. First of all, we banned people from working on Saturday and Sunday or taking work home. Then we started questioning whether a 5-day working week was a good deal for employees and employers alike. Most of the staff started out working traditional office hours, so 9 to 5, Monday to Friday, like everyone else. But recently, we brought in 4-day weeks.
Why was that?
We were finding staff morale was low on Mondays and that staff were generally less productive on Fridays, you know, more focused on planning their weekend.
So there was a lot of time spent not doing much work?
Well, yes, basically. We also had a few employees who were off sick regularly, and as a company, we weren't meeting our deadlines with clients. So we asked our employees what would make the biggest difference to their productivity at work, and one of them jokingly said, a day off a week. After a lot of discussion, we said we'd give it a try.
And their hours have been reduced too?
Yes. They now work 32 hours per week spread over 4 days.
Does that mean your employees earn less at the end of the month?
No, that's the thing. They earn exactly the same as before, but we expect them to be totally switched on and productive in the hours they spend at work.
How long have you been trialling this?
It's been a year, and we've decided to adopt this approach permanently because productivity and motivation have gone up so much. I see the results, and so do our clients. And of course, employees are obviously very happy about working 1 day less. There is another important factor in all this, though.
Oh, what's that?
It's to do with greater flexibility. We actually let staff decide which days they want to work, and they can choose any 4 days, except Saturday and Sunday when we're closed, provided each day is sufficiently covered. This means they have more time to themselves and a better work-life balance. There's further flexibility because their day off can change from week to week, as long as there's enough notice. This results in less time being taken off work for things they need to do, like going to a dental or hospital appointment.
I can think of plenty of things to do with an extra day off every week.
I think we all can. Our employees have been doing more of the things they love with that extra day, whether that's taking long weekend breaks, going to see friends and family, or doing DIY. The overall result is that they seem less stressed.
I've got some statistics here from a 2018 study that found the UK lost 12.5 million working days as a result of stress at work.
That's no surprise. The good news is that we're rethinking how we work. Over the past decade, our always-on culture means even when you go home, the work doesn't stop, and that adds to the pressure. It's another thing we're trying to avoid at Webcraft because we care about our employees.
I'm all for less work at home and a shorter working week, and hope it'll soon be the norm. In the meantime, are there any jobs going at your company? Do you ever feel like a hamster caught up in a wheel? Working day in, day out, and craving Fridays. Then, before you know it, it's Monday again. Well, fear no more, because that could all be about to change. With me in the studio was Eddie Green, founder of Webcraft, an innovative website design company in Glasgow, employing 25 people.
Hi there. Good to be here.
Eddie, you've started to make big changes to the working week. Can you tell us what arrangement your company has?
Yeah, sure. As a small company just starting up, a few of the senior staff used to work almost 7 days per week when things got really busy in the first year or two. But since then, things have changed dramatically. First of all, we banned people from working on Saturday and Sunday or taking work home. Then we started questioning whether a 5-day working week was a good deal for employees and employers alike. Most of the staff started out working traditional office hours, so 9 to 5, Monday to Friday, like everyone else. But recently, we brought in 4-day weeks.
Why was that?
We were finding staff morale was low on Mondays and that staff were generally less productive on Fridays, you know, more focused on planning their weekend.
So there was a lot of time spent not doing much work?
Well, yes, basically. We also had a few employees who were off sick regularly, and as a company, we weren't meeting our deadlines with clients. So we asked our employees what would make the biggest difference to their productivity at work, and one of them jokingly said, a day off a week. After a lot of discussion, we said we'd give it a try.
And their hours have been reduced too?
Yes. They now work 32 hours per week, spread over 4 days.
Does that mean your employees earn less at the end of the month?
No, that's the thing. They earn exactly the same as before, but we expect them to be totally switched on and productive in the hours they spend at work.
How long have you been trialing this?
It's been a year, and we've decided to adopt this approach permanently because productivity and motivation have gone up so much. I see the results, and so do our clients. And of course, employees are obviously very happy about working 1 day less. There is another important factor in all this, though.
Oh, what's that?
It's to do with greater flexibility. We actually let staff decide which days they want to work, and they can choose any 4 days, except Saturday and Sunday when we're closed, provided each day is sufficiently covered. This means they have more time to themselves and a better work-life balance. There's further flexibility because their day off can change from week to week, as long as there's enough notice. This results in less time being taken off work for things they need to do, like going to a dental or hospital appointment.
I can think of plenty of things to do with an extra day off every week.
I think we all can. Our employees have been doing more of the things they love with that extra day, whether that's taking long weekend breaks, going to see friends and family, or doing DIY. The overall result is that they seem less stressed.
I've got some statistics here from a 2018 study that found the UK lost 12.5 million working days as a result of stress at work.
That's no surprise. The good news is that we're rethinking how we work. Over the past decade, our always-on culture means even when you go home, the work doesn't stop, and that adds to the pressure. It's another thing we're trying to avoid at Webcraft because we care about our employees.
I'm all for less work at home and a shorter working week, and hope it'll soon be the norm. In the meantime, are there any jobs going at your company?
Recording 3. Listen to the recording and attempt the questions which follow. You will hear the recording twice. You now have 1 minute to read the questions in recording 3 before the recording begins.
And in half an hour, my colleague Andy will be here with all the sport. But before that, you're here with me, Musa Adebayo, for the big debate. Now, another student has hired a lawyer and taken his university to court for bad teaching, but without success. Here in the studio, we've got Paul Scott, a student activist, and Julia Cameron, principal of the University of Carlisle, to debate the issues. Paul, hello.
Hi, Musa.
On your website, you call it Power to Students, there's a page called Take Your University to Court. Shouldn't you be getting on with your studies rather than making trouble for your lecturers?
3 points. First, I study law, so my website is an integral part of my studies. Second, my lecturers have been excellent so far, and I won't be taking them to court anytime soon. Third, a number of students from other universities have contacted me detailing all kinds of bad experiences, from repeatedly cancelled lectures, to gender discrimination, to simply incompetent marking. Where this can be proved, they have the legal right to compensation.
Time to bring you in, Julia.
Hi, Musa.
So, Julia, surely you accept that when universities like yours treat their students badly, they should be subject to legal challenge and pay up, shouldn't they? They're paying you enough.
Well, of course, there are very few occasions where an educational institution really lets students down and breaks its promises. And as a last resort, I suppose the student could go to court. But is that really what we want our university teachers to be spending their time doing? Defending themselves in court rather than teaching?
You could make the same argument about doctors, but patients have the right to sue.
Well, a lot of people would say patients' rights have gone too far. But if we can get back to the topic. Over the last few years, we've had a lot of time wasted in court. The student in Kent who sued the university for failing him when he was found to have plagiarised. He'd copied material from the internet. A student from Oxford who sued his university 15 years after he didn't get a first-class degree, claiming that it hurt his career and his mental health. And then the Australian case, where a student fails an assignment, it's remarked as another fail, he goes all through the appeals process and then ends up hopelessly in court for one more try.
Paul, isn't it true that all these desperate cases just wasted everyone's time?
Well, Julia's made some valid points there, but we don't know all of the facts about these cases and we shouldn't rush to judgment. No doubt some of these students shouldn't have gone all the way to court, but in my opinion, many students still have a strong case against their uni or college, the strongest ones being where, again and again, seminars and lectures were cancelled for no obvious reason.
I've had a look at your website, Paul, and a number of these cases you're talking about were from a fake college, a so-called business college in central Scotland, which was just a name. It had no intention of providing any classes and didn't even have any premises. That's quite different from reputable colleges and universities.
What? So you shouldn't be able to take a college to court if it's got a good reputation and nice buildings, but you can if it's a new one?
Not at all. Just that most educational institutions do a good job. I don't want listeners to think that we're out to cheat our students, or that taking us to court is generally a good idea. Surely it's far more sensible to raise a problem in a friendlier way with your tutors at a much earlier stage.
Strong opinions there, and thank you both. But that's where we're leaving it for the moment. Just an update on the traffic before we meet our next guests, who will be talking about an individual who took on a supermarket. And in half an hour, my colleague Andy will be here with all the sport. But before that, you're here with me, Musa Adebayo, for the big debate. Now, another student has hired a lawyer and taken his university to court for bad teaching, but without success. Here in the studio, we've got Paul Scott, a student activist, and Julia Cameron, principal of the University of Carlisle, to debate the issues. Paul, hello.
Hi, Musa.
On your website, you call it Power to Students, there's a page called Take Your University to Court. Shouldn't you be getting on with your studies rather than making trouble for your lecturers?
3 points. First, I study law, so my website is an integral part of my studies. Second, my lecturers have been excellent so far, and I won't be taking them to court anytime soon. Third, a number of students from other universities have contacted me detailing all kinds of bad experiences, from repeatedly cancelled lectures to gender discrimination to simply incompetent marking. Where this can be proved, they have the legal right to compensation.
Time to bring you in, Julia.
Hi, Musa.
So, Julia, surely you accept that when universities like yours treat their students badly, they should be subject to legal challenge and pay up, shouldn't they? They're paying you enough.
Well, of course, there are very few occasions where an educational institution really lets students down and breaks its promises. And as a last resort, I suppose the student could go to court. But is that really what we want our university teachers to be spending their time doing? Defending themselves in court rather than teaching?
You could make the same argument about doctors, but patients have the right to sue.
Well,
when they...
a lot of people would say patients' rights have gone too far. But if we can get back to the topic. Over the last few years, we've had a lot of time wasted in court. The student in Kent who sued the university for failing him when he was found to have plagiarised. He'd copied material from the internet. A student from Oxford who sued his university 15 years after he didn't get a first-class degree, claiming that it hurt his career and his mental health. And then the Australian case, where a student fails an assignment, it's remarked as another fail, he goes all through the appeals process and then ends up hopelessly in court for one more try.
Paul, isn't it true that all these desperate cases just wasted everyone's time?
Well, Julia's made some valid points there, but we don't know all of the facts about these cases and we shouldn't rush to judgment. No doubt some of these students shouldn't have gone all the way to court, but in my opinion, many students still have a strong case against their uni or college, the strongest ones being where, again and again, seminars and lectures were cancelled for no obvious reason.
I've had a look at your website, Paul, and a number of these cases you're talking about were from a fake college, a so-called business college in central Scotland, which was just a name. It had no intention of providing any classes and didn't even have any premises. That's quite different from reputable colleges and universities.
What? So you shouldn't be able to take a college to court if it's got a good reputation and nice buildings, but you can if it's a new one?
Not at all. Just that most educational institutions do a good job. I don't want listeners to think that we're out to cheat our students, or that taking us to court is generally a good idea. Surely it's far more sensible to raise a problem in a friendlier way with your tutors at a much earlier stage.
Strong opinions there, and thank you both. But that's where we're leaving it for the moment. Just an update on the traffic before we meet our next guests, who will be talking about an individual who took on a supermarket.
You now have 1 minute to check your answers.
This is the end of the listening test.